This is edition number 1985 of the Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 19th of September, 2025. You're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 18th of September 2025. My name is Jeannie Marden and my fellow readers are
Pauline Andrews,
Dorrie Brecken
and Beau Williams.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise at 6:40 and will set at about 6:50. Thank you for voting for the Mardler through the Blue Token Scheme at Tesco in Aylsham. Please keep on doing this up to the 30th of September.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a candid history of what the can did for us. Two parts of the neither shaggy nor woolly story of the West Runton Mammoth and how a couple invite you into their crooked past. We also hear from our roving reporter, Georgie, who has led a runner on his 10-kilometre run round Stratford Park in London. They chat about how visual impairment does not need to rule out physical exercise at any level.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the sad death of a young motorcyclist and a second car crash involving teenagers. Then a man is banned from travelling next to lone women on public transport, and a heated parish council meeting is adjourned with three on-the-spot resignations. We also have news from a care home, a potential film studio, a site for Afghan refugees who are not asylum seekers, as well as a new seat for Norwich football fans. Let's start with those lead stories.
A 19-year-old motorcyclist was killed in a crash involving another bike and a car. Louis Hines died following the accident on the Beeler Road at Hoveton at around 9:20pm on Friday. His former school, Stalham High, issued a statement paying tribute to a determined and well-natured young man, while a GoFundMe page has been set up to raise money for funeral costs. A statement on the page, which has already raised more than £5,000, said, "On the 12th of September, our beloved Louis Hines tragically lost his life in a motorbike accident. At just 19 years old, his life was cut far too short, leaving his family and friends devastated beyond words. Louis will always be remembered as a loving son to Carrie and a devoted brother to Rene. Carrie, a single mum, now faces the unimaginable pain of saying goodbye to her son far too soon." In its statement, Stalham High School said, "It is with great sadness that we mark the sudden and tragic death of former Stalham High School student Louis Hines. Louis will be fondly remembered by all who worked with him during his time at our school. He was a determined and well-natured young man." Norfolk Police are appealing for witnesses following the crash between a green Kawasaki GX636 motorbike Louis was riding, a blue Yamaha MT-07 motorbike and a white Ford Focus. The Yamaha rider in his 20s remains in hospital with serious injuries. The driver of the Ford Focus, a man in his 20s, was treated for minor injuries. Anyone with relevant information should contact police, quoting reference NC12092025565. Meanwhile, a person was airlifted to hospital after a crash between a bin lorry and a car at about 9:15am yesterday on Reedham Road in Freethorpe. The exact nature of injuries suffered in the crash by the car passenger is currently unknown. A motorcyclist was taken to hospital after a crash closed a road for nearly 3 hours. Emergency services, including police, fire and ambulance, were called at 10am on Sunday following a single vehicle collision involving a motorbike on the B1108 at Barford.
Seven teenagers were taken to hospital after the vehicle they were travelling in crashed into a tree. The teens were in a silver Citroen Berlingo when it left Mill Road in Wells at around 10:45 p.m. on Friday. Emergency services, including the East Anglian Air Ambulance, attended. Two of the seven remain in Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge, and one remains in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in King's Lynn. The driver was arrested at the scene on suspicion of drink driving and causing serious injury by dangerous driving. After being checked over in hospital, he was taken to King's Lynn Police Investigation Centre for questioning. He has since been released on bail while inquiries continue. Police are now appealing for anyone who witnessed or captured footage of the collision or the vehicle's manner of driving beforehand to get in touch. They should call 101 or email jordan.pocorney@norfolk.police.uk, quoting reference 611 of September the 12th, 2025.
A man has been banned from sitting next to lone women on public transport after sexually assaulting female train passengers. William Horsfield, 45, groped one woman, rubbed the legs of another under the table while another was followed after getting off the train to get away from him. He targeted the women, two of whom were in their teens, as they travelled alone on journeys between North Walsham, Sheringham and Norwich. Norwich Magistrates Court was told on each occasion he wore sunglasses, which the women believed was to disguise him eyeing them up. His creepy behaviour also included asking quiz questions, telling one woman who got an answer wrong, "Naughty, I'm going to have to spank your bum." Horsfield of Vicarage Road in North Walsham pleaded guilty to three counts of sexual assault, which took place on November the 26th and 27th last year. Sally Harris, prosecuting, said he had deliberately chosen to sit either opposite or next to a female passenger. On one occasion, he had spread his legs so they were repeatedly rubbing against those of a 17-year-old student. Another journey saw him sit opposite a 43-year-old before touching her thighs, pushing his foot against her and moving his hands inside his coat, which she believed may have been him masturbating. He also grabbed the hips of an 18-year-old shop worker as she attempted to escape his attention. In a statement read in court, she said the experience had left her paranoid and terrified of travelling alone. His behaviour had escalated from staring to touching to following me from the train into the town centre, she added. Magistrates sentenced him to 24 weeks, suspended for 18 months, with rehabilitation requirements and 100 hours unpaid work. A 5-year-old sexual harm prevention order also stops him sitting next to or opposite any lone female on any form of public transport, except where other seats are not available. It also bans him from sitting next to women and girls in train stations. He was also placed on the sex offenders register for 7 years. James Burrows, mitigating, said he is absolutely appalled and disgusted about his behaviour and the impact it has had on others. He said a diagnosed delusional disorder had a significant impact on his actions at a time when he was not being treated for it.
Three parish councillors dramatically quit as tempers flared in an extraordinary meeting after a heated row erupted about a disgraced ex-councillor convicted of multiple sex offences. The fallout at Trimmingham Parish Council followed the conviction of Matthew Cooper for filming a boy with a secret camera, among other offences. Cooper is a former Trimmingham Parish councillor who once chaired a fundraising committee to raise money for a new village hall. The meeting, held on Wednesday in the village near Cromer, was thrown into turmoil as three sitting councillors in attendance dramatically resigned in the middle of the tense argument. Among them was Chairman Elizabeth King, who declared her immediate resignation for knowing about Cooper's arrest from as early as April 2023. The former chair of the council said she had been aware of horrendous situation from the beginning and had tried to behave beyond reproach, taking the view that people are innocent until proven guilty. She added she had distanced herself from Cooper, but said, "I feel that some might not accept my behaviour, and I do not wish the parish council to come into any uncomfortable situation, hence my resignation." Her declaration stunned the table of the six other councillors and the 11 members of the public at the back. The clerk, June Collingwood, suggested a new chair needed to be elected before saying, "We have to think of the good name of the council, and we have to ask councillors who knew of Cooper's behaviour." An argument ensued following Mrs. King's announcement, and councillors hurled accusations across the table, accusing others of lying about what they knew about the situation. Councillor Richard Wallace declared fellow councillor Patrick Carpmile is quite friendly with Cooper, and said he had, with his own eyes, seen the pair in deep conversation recently. Mr. Carpmile said Cooper had done a lot for the parish council over the years and that they had all trusted him. He added it was difficult to divorce how people acted in public compared to what they were doing in their private lives. But Mr. Wallace then turned on Mr. Carpmile, declaring that he was not fit to sit on the council and that his comments made his stomach turn, and he needs to take a long, hard look at himself. The tension escalated further as Councillor Terry Brown and his wife Linda, who were sitting in the public gallery, stormed out of the meeting after Mr. Wallace accused them of having known about the arrest but not sharing that information with him. Mr. Brown said he was resigning. As they left the room, Mr. Cartmell announced his resignation on the spot. The meeting was adjourned after Councillor Chris Harrison said it was becoming a witch hunt and the clerk said the atmosphere had become rather heated. According to the Parish Council website, they are not scheduled to have another meeting until November the 12th and need to elect a new chairperson.
Glenholm Care Home in Cromer was visited by the Care Quality Commission following a host of concerns being raised about the quality of its service. The home in Cabell Road provides care and support for people with autism and learning disabilities, and at the time of its inspection had 16 residents. But measures have now been put in place preventing it from taking in any new residents unless it is given express permission by the CQC. Inspectors found a closed culture within the service, with staff failing to correctly report incidents or learn lessons from them. The inspection reads, "We found people were not always safe and protected from harm due to the service's lack of processes and the condition of the environment. There was not a safe number of staff to meet people's needs, and staff were not trained appropriately." Following the inspection, which was carried out across July and August, the home was placed into special measures by the CQC. However, despite the concerns, some family members told inspectors they were happy with how their loved one was being treated. One family member told inspectors, "The staff do a great job. My loved one always looks clean and tidy. They are supported, they eat well and are offered activities." But the report added that there were several concerns in the expected standards of care at the facility. Over the course of the inspection, the home's then registered manager resigned and was replaced, with the new manager joining at the end of the assessment. The home was given an overall rating as inadequate as well as across the board. Beacon Care Homes Limited, which runs the home, has been approached for comment.
North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, has approved businessman Roger Gorn's plans to create a film studio at the Tattersett Business Park near Fakenham. An outline application had been approved in December 2024 on the proviso that nutrient neutrality restrictions, rules to prevent river pollution from new developments, were resolved. After lengthy discussions with Natural England, Anglian Water and flood experts, the scheme has been given the green light by officers with a number of conditions. The water firm had sent a letter of objection to NNDC after it was approved last year, worrying it would cause environmental harm due to its insufficient infrastructure capacity in the area. AW continued to object to the scheme as late as last month, saying its nearest water treatment plant would be unable to cope with the additional pressure placed upon it. To address the issue, a series of conditions was suggested by the firm. But NNDC proposed its own, calling on the developer to provide a detailed explanation for how it will dispose of foul water before the development can commence. Mr. Gorn's film studio would be close to Siderstone Common, a site of special scientific interest. But Natural England officials decided there would not be a direct impact on the protected area. It is thought the project, located on a former RAF base, will cost between £50 million and £100 million. It could also create 350 direct jobs and a further 250 indirect ones. Mr. Gorn, who owns the Melton Hall stately home in Melton Constable, is best known for his vast tyre collection, located at the same 37-acre site in North Norfolk. He has been in the process of removing the tyres for several years, and there is a little insert picture of him standing in front of a mountain of tyres.
A contractor working for the Home Office has applied for permission to use the former officers' mess at RAF Caldishall as immigration accommodation. The scheme comes at a time of heightened national debate over immigration, with flashpoints at other sites used to house migrants, including in Norfolk, and the bid is likely to prove controversial. Private firm BM Trust, which has lodged the plans with Broadland Council, says the site would be used to house Afghans who worked with the British following the invasion of their country in 2001 and their families. The Home Office has been using local authorities to help find transitional accommodation for the refugees who are part of the government's Afghan resettlement programme, while long-term homes are found for them. The families who would move there are not asylum seekers and are eligible to relocate and resettle in the UK. The site closed as an RAF base in 2006. BM Trust has submitted plans with Broadland to make use of the former RAF base's Jaguar House, which was built in 1938 and Grade 2 listed, and other nearby buildings for a temporary period of 12 months. The buildings are currently empty. For a short period between 2020 and 2021, they were used by the government and Broadland Council to house asylum seekers and homeless people, while farm workers lived there in the summer of 2001. The previous use for asylum seekers sparked controversy. While some people delivered gifts, there were also complaints to the police and parish council. Documents submitted by BM Trust state many Afghan refugees are currently housed on MOD training camps across the UK. As central government has increased MOD spending, there is a need to recruit and train an increasing number of personnel to help improve national security in the long term. However, currently many of the training camps do not have the capacity due to occupation by Afghan refugees who have been allowed to relocate to the UK. There is therefore a pressing need to find transitional accommodation to relocate the refugees from training camps as well as hotel accommodation, whilst more long-term accommodation is found. The applicant says families and individuals will be supported to claim benefits and will be temporarily registered with a GP before they are assessed for their resettlement needs. Plans will then be put in place to either support them to find private rented homes or matched with suitable properties provided by councils in the east of England. Primary and school-age children would be educated on site, while those of secondary school age would be enrolled in local schools. There will be staff on site, including security, while Norfolk County Council's people from abroad team would provide social care support and English speaking classes. The Afghan families will be able to leave the site to use local facilities such as shops. Dan Roper, Liberal Democrat Cabinet Member for Planning at Broadland, said, "As much as the government would like a quick decision, they will have to be realistic. This will take quite a bit of time to consider, as we need to take into account all the support needs required for residents. It will be considered carefully, and we will not be rushed by the government on this." Mr. Roper added that the process will be transparent and a decision will be made in public by the planning committee. The plans will be considered by Broadland District Council in due course.
Together Dental in Augusta Street, Sheringham, applied to install a non-illuminated metal panel on two posts in the garden at the front of its premises. Standing at just over 2 metres tall, the sign will sit on the boundary at the junction with Morris Street. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, has given the green light, but only on condition the sign is non-reflective and does not overhang the highway to avoid distracting motorists or resemble official road signs. The decision came in the face of strong criticism. Councillor Liz Withington branded the proposal incongruous and warned it would detract from the quality and coherence of the street scene in Sheringham's Edwardian Conservation Area. She also raised fears the sign could block sight lines near the Morris Street short-stay car park, creating what she called a real risk to drivers and pedestrians in an already congested spot. Three locals living in Augusta Street and Morris Street objected in writing. One described the sign as unnecessary and branded it hazardous and too close to the roadside, while a third insisted yet another sign was not needed when one already exists on the building. But while NNDC's own conservation and design officers admitted the design appeared not to be much more than a plastic sheet with lettering printed on, and larger than is strictly necessary, they said the impact would not be significant enough to justify refusal. Sheringham Town Council raised no objection, and Norfolk County Council highways officials said safety would not be compromised if conditions were met.
More than 8,900 motorists on Norfolk roads were caught over the speed limit by camera van checks in June and July. Roadside operations by the Norfolk and Suffolk Safety Camera Partnership covered main routes including the A11 and the A47, as well as smaller routes in numerous towns and villages across the county. The biggest speeding hotspot was Thetford, where 819 motorists, 561 in June and 258 in July, were detected to be travelling over the limit. Cameras positioned at the busy Broadland interchange on the A47 at Postwick with Witton on the outskirts of Norwich clocked 577. On the A11, mobile vans caught the most, travelling on the A11 at Snetterton, where 453 were detected. The onset of the busy summer months saw the numbers higher than all the preceding months this year, with 8,965 in total. Camera vans are often deployed on bridges overlooking the carriageway or in laybys to use video speed monitoring tech. Motorists caught are sent a notice of intended prosecution, but for more serious speeding offences, the police may choose to take cases straight to court.
North Norfolk District Council wishes to reinforce the cliff edge in Cromer beside the Watch House, which overlooks the coastline above the Rocket House. The site is bounded by Brunswick Terrace to the west and a former bowling green and housing to the south. The scheme involves installing gabion baskets, wire cages filled with stone, along a 24-metre stretch of the cliff edge within the private boundary of the property. The baskets are designed to support the failing cliff face, while minimising disruption from heavy machinery. Fence posts would be secured into the gabions while surface water drainage would connect into the existing Anglian water system through a new gully and manhole. The plans stress that the works are for safety, not development, with no new buildings proposed. The garden and lawn will be reinstated once the works are complete, with the gabions designed to blend into the natural landscape. The council is expected to make a decision by October 31st.
Kieran Taylor, who runs Taylor Upholstery, covered an armchair using four Norwich City shirts. The chair is on sale for £800, and Mr. Taylor claims he has received a large amount of interest in the piece of furniture. "I posted it Saturday morning and ended up spending almost all day on my phone," he said. "I made it between other jobs, so it took me a couple of days to get it finished up. The good thing about football shirts is that they stretch a lot. I bought four shirts in XXXL, which is the largest size the club sell them in, but I still needed them to stretch a fair bit." Mr. Taylor said the interest the chair has received has motivated him to offer more shirt chairs on his website in the near future. He can also offer football shirt scatter cushions. Taylor Upholstery has a showroom at North Walsham Garden Centre, and the Norwich City wingback is currently on display there.
You are listening to edition number 1985 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 19th of September, 2025. Still to come, there are items about a successful summer for a young lifeguard, a campaign which manages to achieve its aim, and a treasure find goes under the hammer. Then we look at some animal issues, including marine conservation, equine protection, domestic pet promotion, and bird spotting, as well as, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
This letter is from Paul McGilchrist from Cromer, entitled "Abuse Has Hurt Town Image." "I was appalled to read about the racial abuse suffered by the Green Party deputy leader Mothin Ali on Cromer Beach recently, but pleased to learn that Cromer Mayor Richard Lees and Lib Dem MP Steph Acheron have condemned those responsible, as well as, of course, being deeply distressing to Mr. Mothin and his family. The incident is also injurious to all Cromer residents. Reputations, however hard won, can be lost in the blink of an eye, and it is all too easy for those unacquainted with the town to imagine, wrongly, that such behaviour is in some way representative, when that could hardly be further from the truth. As a black visitor to Cromer for over 15 years and a resident for the last three, I am convinced that this incident is evidence only of the poisonous attitudes encouraged by irresponsible political commentary and is not in the least reflective of any such tendency that is homegrown in Cromer. Luckily, Cromer's renown as a good-humoured, relaxing, welcoming haven for those in search of wide-open skies, sea and hearts offers reliable insurance against any ill-deserved poor impression and will not be invalidated by the madness imported from elsewhere."
From Paul Milner of Sheringham. OAPs, old age pensioners, they have to put up with a lot of old stick from those who should know better. So I was pleased to see a well-known lady around my age, no words, no pack drill, speaking up for the oldies. Yes, it was Dame Helen Mirren, who said what really annoys her and her husband was being condescendingly called sweet by younger people. Pensioners are frequently targeted by politicians, the media, the working young and middle-aged. They are either seen as well-off baby boomers with big cars and bigger houses, or they are a liability and a cost to society. This is not only insulting, unfair and untrue, but ignores the years of contributions and tax they have paid for 40 or more years. Two-fifths of old people, over 2 million, volunteer for at least two charities, schools, clubs, activity groups and associations. Many care for elderly parents, as well as childmind their grandchildren, to allow their own offspring to go to work. They also give back, serving as councillors. 37% of local authority councillors in England are over 65. According to the Centre of Economic and Business Research, this unpaid work contributes over £48 billion a year to the UK economy. Pensioners do unpaid charity work because it's rewarding, and retirement can engender a sense of loss, loneliness, and lack of worth. Next time someone says old people are a drain on society, I suggest they consider how many organisations would collapse without their OAP volunteers.
And now to this week's obituaries.
June Leask Nee Adams, on September the 6th, beloved wife of John, loving mum to Raymond, mum-in-law to Sally, and a loving nanny. The funeral service will take place at St Faith's Crematorium on Monday, October the 6th, at 2:30 p.m. Family flowers only, please, however donations, if desired, for the Alzheimer's Society can be left at the chapel on the day. All inquiries to Gordon Barber, Hovden, 01603 783 500.
And now some articles to stimulate your diary planning.
Looking as far ahead as Christmas, the Norfolk Lights Express, which runs along the North Norfolk Railway between Sheringham and Holt, was included in the Times' roundup of the 16 best festive train experiences. The event sees the outside of a historic locomotive being covered with thousands of bright lights. These lights change colour, illuminating the area during the 11-mile return journey. Passengers can also enjoy music and photo opportunities as they travel. The 2025 Norfolk Lights Express will be particularly special as it coincides with the Heritage Railway's 50th anniversary celebrations. Tickets must be pre-booked for all of the events, which will run from Friday, November the 14th, until Saturday the 3rd of January. The railway will also operate Santa Special steam trains on weekends from November the 22nd to December the 21st, and from December the 22nd to 23rd. These feature balloon modellers, mulled cider, and the chance to meet Father Christmas.
A free history day focused on wartime activities is set to take place in Aylsham. Aylsham History Day will return to the Town Hall on September the 27th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. with the theme Aylsham in the Second World War. The theme concludes a series of town events marking the anniversary of the end of the Second World War, including VE Day celebrations, the Friendly Invasion Walks, and the VJ Day Trail. The day will feature information about Aylsham in wartime, games, activities, artefacts, and also military vehicles in the marketplace. The Royal British Legion, RAF Alton, and Aylsham History Society will take part, along with an archivist on hand to engage with visitors. Families can try an escape room-style puzzle, Morse code deciphering and a rationing activity. Those taking part in rationing can pick up a ration book from the town hall and visit participating shops to collect food rations, which can then be used to bake treats from a wartime recipe. Refreshments will be provided.
And this October, Kelling Heath Holiday Park will host a magical event to mark the opening of its new dark sky viewing platform. The weekend-long Wild Sky event will run from October the 3rd to the 5th, with the platform officially opened by television astronomer Mark Thompson, best known for his appearances on the BBC's Stargazing Live. Thompson, an astronomer, author and broadcaster, will also give a short talk, sharing his passion for astronomy and the wonders of the night sky. The North Norfolk Astronomical Society will run on the same evening with members on hand with telescopes. Kelling Heath is one of the best places in England to see the starry skies and was awarded Dark Sky Discovery Site status in September 2017. Weekend camping tickets start at £70.
And if theatre is your thing, a fading Hollywood action hero is the subject of a theatre production in Munsley. The Munsley Players are set to stage A Bunch of Amateurs between October the 29th and November the 1st at 7:30 p.m. in Coronation Hall. It tells the story of Jefferson Steele, whose career is in decline. He arrives in England to play King Lear in Stratford, only to find himself in a sleepy Suffolk village in an amateur theatre production. Tickets £10 on the door.
We now turn to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where there is a canned history of food preservation, two of several parts of the ongoing story of the woolly mammoth of West Runton, and a hint of a crooked past in Suffolk. We finish this section with a recorded interview from our roving reporter Georgie, who has accompanied Chris as a guide runner on his 10-kilometre run around Stratford Park in London. They chat about how visual impairment does not need to rule out physical exercise at any level.
Joanne Curran explores the surprising history of canned food in this article in the People's Friend, special number 273. The humble tin can remains a common feature in Britain's kitchens, with a survey by Kantar showing that 99.4% of UK households buy canned food each year in an industry worth £2.2 billion. A survey by MPMA in 2017 found that 60% of UK families said they can't live without baked beans, 50% feel the same way about tinned tomatoes, and 38% about tinned tuna or salmon. A quarter also said they couldn't live without tinned soup. It's believed that the first tinned food to be sold in the UK was corned beef. And the town of Burton Latimer, near Kettering, is home to the UK's largest aluminium can packing plant. It started construction in 2022 and opened a year later. Run by the Ball Corporation, the plant produces more than 1 billion cans per year and employs more than 170 people. Napoleon Bonaparte famously said that an army marches on its stomach. Perhaps it's fitting that we have the infamous French military commander to thank for the invention of canned food. In 1795, Napoleon offered 12,000 francs to whomever could invent a new way to preserve food in order to keep his troops fed. 15 years later, the prize was claimed by confectioner Nicolas Appert, who developed a way to heat, boil and seal food in airtight glass jars. His process is the same basic technology used today. Englishman Peter Durand took the process one step further and developed a method of sealing food into unbreakable containers. That process was perfected by Brian Dorkin and John Hall, who set up the first commercial canning factory in England in 1813. No one knew why canning was so effective until more than 50 years later, when Louis Pasteur discovered that microbes, which can be killed at high temperatures, were the cause of food spoilage. Canned food quickly became a core feature of British life, playing a key role in both world wars. By 1918, the British were sending more than £67 million of meat to the Western Front each month, with a large proportion of soldiers' rations consisting of tinned meals such as Mackinocchi's beef and vegetable stew. Suffolk-born brothers Archibald and James Mackinocchi set up a fish canning business in Aberdeenshire. They went on to win a huge contract to supply the British Army with a stew during the Boer War and World War I. The cans boasted that the contents contained the finest beef and vegetables. Accounts from the front line differed. One soldier reportedly said, "Warmed in a tin, Mackinocchi's was edible. Cold, it was a man-killer." Preserved foods played an equally crucial role in World War II, with tins of bully beef, spam, stew and beans a common sight in soldiers' ration packs. Home canning also became hugely important during wartime as food became scarce. The British government issued posters urging families to preserve fruit, vegetables and meats, using slogans such as "Can all you can," and "Of course I can." The Women's Institute took on the mission with gusto, with some branches setting up professional canning centres and mobile canning vans. Heinz divided opinion in 2024 when it launched its spaghetti carbonara in a can. The move hit the headlines with BBC Radio 4 presenter Johnny Diamond asking listeners whether the £2 product amounted to the end of culinary civilization or the kind of leap forward that brought up the joy of pot noodles and microwave meals. Other unusual choices have included tinned all-day breakfast, canned whole chicken, and even brown bread in a can. However, canned food supporters are keen to emphasise how it can be an important source of essential nutrients, while also providing convenience and value for money as cost of living rises. TV chef Phil Vickery has based several cookbooks around tinned food and is an ambassador for the Love of Canned Food campaign. He has described canned food's appeal, saying, "People are squeezed, budgets are squeezed, and it's just a perfect way of utilising what's around." He firmly believes canned food is an important kitchen companion for chefs and family alike. "I always keep my kitchen cupboard stocked with a wide range of canned fruits, meats, fish and vegetables," he says. "There is such a diverse selection of ingredients now available in cans, meaning families can create stunning recipes with ingredients from all over the globe that can be kept in their kitchen cupboards." This makes canned food the perfect partner for modern shoppers looking to keep up with food trends, as well as families simply trying to diversify the meals that they eat each week and their intake of fruit and veg.
This article about the West Runton elephant was written in 1997, almost 30 years ago, by A.J. Stewart for the Norfolk Museum Service. Travelling around Norfolk today, we see a gently rolling landscape with fields, woodland, heaths, wetlands and built-up areas. A varied North Sea coastline ranges from cliffs to salt marshes and sandbanks. Although much wildlife is still to be found, nature has retreated everywhere in the face of thousands of years of human activity. This is hardly a part of the world that one would associate with elephants, rhinos, or giant moose. Yet fossil finds tell us that these and many other animals once roamed the forests and grasslands of what is now East Anglia. From time to time, powered by northwesterly gales, the sea pounds against the soft crumbling cliffs along the North Norfolk coast, exposing the layers of sediment laid down hundreds of thousands of years ago during the Quaternary period, known informally as the Ice Age. The continuing retreat of the cliffs also brings to light fossil teeth and bones, all that remains of the ancient inhabitants of the region. This is the story of the discovery and excavation of the most spectacular of these fossil finds, the oldest and largest fossil elephant skeleton ever to have been found in Britain. Most of Norfolk is underlain by chalk, a kind of limestone deposited in a subtropical sea between about 70 and 97 million years ago, the late Cretaceous period. On top of the chalk are extensive deposits of much younger sands, gravels, clays, and other soft sediments of the Quaternary period, dating from about 1.5 million years ago up to the present day. The Quaternary period, or Ice Age, was by no means uniformly cold, but showed marked changes in climate on a timescale of a few thousand years. In Britain, deciduous forest clothed the landscape in the warmest phases or interglacials, while treeless steppe or prairie or tundra-like vegetation grew during the cold phases. At times during these cold phases, ice sheets covered extensive areas of northern Europe, including Britain. About 400,000 years ago, in the Anglian cold period, Britain was in the grip of an Arctic climate, and an ice sheet several kilometres thick extended over most of Britain, as far south as what is now North London. Boulder clay, debris comprising clay, sand, gravel and boulders, was dumped by the melting ice, while layers of sands and gravels were deposited by escaping meltwater. These glacial sediments blanket much of East Anglia and can be seen at many places on the coast exposed in the cliffs where the sea has eroded the land. Exposed in the cliffs and on the foreshore, beneath the boulder clay and outwash sands and gravels, and taking us further back in time, are very different sediments known as the Cromer Forest Bed Formation, or Forest Bed for short. It is exposed at intervals along the coast of Norfolk and adjacent Suffolk, from Weybourne to Kessingland. Since the early years of the 19th century, the forest bed has been famous amongst geologists for its wealth of fossil mammal remains. The forest bed and its fossils had an especially powerful attraction for Victorian geologists and fossil collectors. In the first half of the 19th century, Anna Gurney, who lived at Northreps in North Norfolk, obtained many important forest bed fossils by purchasing them from local fishermen. She generously donated this collection to the then Norwich Museum. Another outstanding collector and colourful character was the Reverend John Gunn, a Norfolk vicar in the mid-19th century, and Alfred Savin. They kept a shop in Cromer and actively collected from the 1880s until the 1940s. The best place to see the Cromer Forest Bed is on the coast near the village of West Runton, 2 miles west of Cromer. Between about 200 and 300 metres east of the concrete slipway at West Runton Gap, a prominent dark band can be seen at the base of the cliff. This West Runton freshwater bed teems with fossils ranging from microscopic pollen, seeds, mollusks, shells and beetles to fishes, frogs, birds and large mammals. By comparing the fossils present with those from sites in the Netherlands and Germany, the age of the freshwater bed can be estimated at between 600,000 and 700,000 years.
The story of the West Runton elephant begins on the 13th of December 1990, when, following a storm, naturalists Harold and Margaret Hems took a walk on the beach to see if any fossils had been uncovered by the sea. They found a large bone partly exposed in the face of the freshwater bed, and realising its importance, contacted Norfolk Museum Service. Excavation soon revealed that their find was the pelvic bone of a huge elephant. Next to the pelvis was a much smaller bone, an astragalus, ankle bone, also of an elephant. Fortunately, just over a year after the discovery of the pelvic bone, at Christmas 1991, the freshwater bed was once again eroded by heavy seas. This time, several large bones exposed in the cliff were spotted by another keen-eyed observer, Rob Sinclair, who also realised their importance and informed Norfolk Museum Service. It was now obvious that this was a find of major significance, and in January 1992, a rescue excavation was carried out by staff from Cromer Museum, Norwich Castle Museum and volunteers. This excavation recovered all the bones that could be reached without unsafe tunnelling into the cliff face. In total, about a quarter of the skeleton, including most of the backbone, parts of the right front limb, and of particular importance for identifying the type of elephant, the lower jaw. One large limb bone, the right humerus, could not be excavated as it went straight into the cliff. A convenient crack made it possible to remove part of the end of the bone, but the rest had to be left, protected by a sturdy, small flint and cement wall built over the broken end. Over a period of 2 years, the new finds were painstakingly conserved by Rob Driscoll of the Castle Museum and volunteers Sonia Smith and Julie Curl. This Mammuthus trogonotheri, the species found at West Runton, gave rise to the well-known but much smaller woolly mammoth, Mammuthus primigenius, especially characteristic of the cold environments of the later part of the Ice Age. Woolly mammoths became extinct in Europe as recently as 12,000 years ago, but survived even later until at least 4,000 years ago on Wrangel Island off northeast Siberia. From the bones recovered in 1990 to 1992, the height at the shoulder of the West Runton elephant, when it was alive, could be estimated at 4 metres, its weight at about 10 tonnes, nearly twice the weight of a modern African elephant. Elephant bones were not the only items found. There were also coprolites, fossilised droppings, of spotted hyenas, Crocuta crocuta. Today, these animals are restricted to Africa, south of the Sahara. Hunting in packs, they kill prey up to the size of zebra, and also scavenge carrion, crunching bones with their powerful jaws and teeth. Some of the West Runton elephant bones showed obvious signs of chewing, consistent with hyena damage. Hyenas had fed on the carcass as it lay in the river. This story is to be continued in a future issue of the Mardler magazine.
This article was written for Arts East, autumn 2025. If you've ever driven through the beautiful medieval village of Lavenham, you will have spotted the Crooked House on the High Street. Built in 1395, the Crooked House is said to be the inspiration for the classic nursery rhyme, "There was a crooked man who walked a crooked mile, he found a crooked sixpence," etc., etc. But why is it crooked? In the 14th century, Lavenham was England's richest wool town, and the Crooked House was built as part of a larger house for a wealthy wool merchant. Desperate for his house to be built quickly, the merchant used wood that wasn't fully seasoned. As it dried, the house twisted and contorted, resulting in this very magical building. Today, the Crooked House is home to two self-proclaimed crooked men, husbands Alex and Ollie Khalil Martin, who are sharing the 600-year story of this remarkable place through award-winning immersive experiences. The Crooked Men moved into the Crooked House in 2021, following an unexpected lockdown love story, which saw them buying Britain's wonkiest house just 3 months after meeting. I discovered the house on a chance day trip in 2018 and fell in love with its fairy tale facade, says Alex. Just over a year later, in the middle of lockdown, I met Ollie online and knew I'd found the person I'd spend my life with. I soon told him about the Crooked House. Remarkably, it was up for sale. Ollie loved it as much as I did, and it's now our perfect home. After their life-changing move from London to Lavenham, Alex and Ollie vowed to protect and preserve the home they love and to invite everyone to join their journey. We love living in the Crooked House and want to share its amazing history with everyone, says Alex. The Crooked Men now offer two types of immersive experiences for visitors to enjoy. The first is their award-winning theatrical house tour, The Crooked House Story. Guests are guided by us in period dress through the 600-year story of our ancient home, explains Ollie. It's a fun and immersive journey through time, from the house being built in 1395 all the way through to the present day. The Crooked House has a remarkable history, charting the ups and downs of Lavenham's fortune, adds Alex. Guests on our house tours step inside the medieval weaver's workshop where the famous Lavenham blue cloth was made in the 14th century, making this little village the richest wool town in England. We also share a taste of the past in our Tudor kitchen, exploring how 15th century residents of the Crooked House would have cooked and the ingredients they used. Later, visitors discover the spookier side of this magical place, with tales of witches and ghosts in our 17th century bedroom. Our aim is to fully immerse people in the history of our home and to bring it to life in a way that everyone can enjoy, says Ollie. Alongside these theatrical house tours, the Crooked Men also host black tie dinners in their candlelit home. These special occasions take place around key celebrations throughout the year. Each time, the Crooked Men welcome 16 guests for a champagne reception, followed by a hearty home-cooked three-course meal, complete with a dash of drama and storytelling. Ollie is the chef and takes care to plan each menu using local ingredients, with dishes inspired by the Crooked House's history. Everything we do here is about celebrating the story of the Crooked House, says Ollie. As such, I take inspiration from historical dishes and ingredients to create a new, modern meal with a taste of times past. These black tie dinners at the Crooked House attract guests from across the east of England and around the world. Focused on celebratory occasions, they take place every year at Halloween, Christmas, and on the night of the Crooked Man in March. The Crooked House is said to have inspired the old English nursery rhyme, "There Was a Crooked Man," explains Alex. Each year in March, we therefore host two Night of the Crooked Man black tie dinners, as a fun way to bring this popular poem to life. The evening begins with a magical lantern-lit procession around medieval Lavenham, featuring the characters from the nursery rhyme, followed by a candle-lit dinner at the Crooked Man's table. Both Alex and Ollie are dedicated to keeping the history and tradition of their house alive, so much so that they even shower in the spa across the road to help preserve a 15th-century painting on their bathroom ceiling. We have been welcomed with open arms by the community of Lavenham and are proud to be part of such a special place, says Ollie. All our activity here helps us to preserve and protect the Crooked House for the future, and we feel very fortunate to be living here and sharing this wonderfully wonky place with everyone. Find out more at crookedhouselavenham.com.
So we have just completed 10K around Stratford Olympic Park. My name is Georgie and I've been running today with Chris.
So I'm Chris Blackerby. I have been guided today by Georgie around the Olympic Park in Stratford, East London. And we completed a 10K on a beautiful, slightly breezy, but very nice summer day and really nice time out there.
Lovely. You mentioned you've been guided. Do you want to give a bit of an introduction for anyone that might not know what guide running is?
Sure thing. So I'm totally blind myself and have been running now for around 15 years. So I started running when I was 40 years old. Got into running because mainly I was pretty unfit, was eating and drinking far too much and not living a particularly healthy lifestyle. I just decided that I wanted to change things. So I started going to the gym, quite happy doing my short treadmill runs. I say runs, you know, there was a lot of walking, a little bit of running, and that's how I started. And one of the gym instructors said to me, Chris, have you considered doing anything outside, actually road running? And I said, oh gosh, no, absolutely not. That's really not for me. I wouldn't be able to do that. And I said, but we can guide you. So that's when I was introduced to guide running, and I went out and did a short walk stroke, jog stroke run, and actually quite enjoyed it. I continued with that to a point where I was running a lot less in the gym and actually started to enjoy 5K runs. But I didn't learn to run overnight to 5K. You know, it took me quite some time to build up to that. And then gradually over time, that developed into slightly longer distances. And of course, then I needed to find more guide runners. And over time, I started running with more runners, really developed my love for the sport.
Amazing. And you mentioned how you got started, but you've gone on to run immense distances and achieve great things as a runner.
Yeah, so in 2016, I was introduced to Achilles International. I was invited to go and run my very first full marathon in Budapest in Hungary. Didn't know very much about Achilles International. And anyway, I went off, did the Budapest Marathon and had a fantastic time. I then learned more about Achilles and the opportunities that they afforded to visually impaired runners and runners with many different disabilities and not just visual impairment. I did a couple of other events with them. I was very privileged to go to New York and several other events. And in 2019, they asked me if I would like to set up the UK chapter of Achilles. So Achilles UK was born in 2019. We are London-based in the main currently. We have approximately 12 runners and 12 guides each week. We meet generally at one of the London Underground stations and then run together as a team. Some will walk. You are paired with a guide and you can do anything from walking, going up to some of our guys are training for ultra marathons, and we have guides to support every runner of every single ability.
Amazing. So we met at Achilles UK chapter when I joined as a guide. And I think what really struck me was the range of runners that are at Achilles, and you meet such a wonderful diverse range of people.
So in terms of age, I think we probably have some of our people who are kind of mid-20s going up to one of our ladies who next birthday, she's 81. Admittedly, Janice has been a runner for many years now, and she's still managing to do 5 kilometers, which is give or take about 3 miles. And she's still managing to do that in around 30 minutes. So incredibly inspiring. Our runners are from different backgrounds, different ages, and every single one of our people gets treated the same.
I think maybe some people would think that they need a person that regularly guides them in order to get into walking or running. But Achilles allows for anyone to be paired on the day and to ensure that everyone can be guided to ensure your safety and you can have an enjoyable run.
Definitely. So I think over time, I've run with umpteen guides. In terms of finding guides, there's several ways. My job now with Achilles UK is to go out and find guides. And then when people come to us looking for running opportunities, we will actually pair them with people who can assist them at their pace, making sure that we don't push our guides too hard. So we're very mindful of who we pair people with. I've found probably people from community groups, volunteering groups, park run. So park run is a timed 5K event that happens every Saturday morning in different towns all around the UK. So I would definitely recommend, if you were looking to take up some physical activity on a Saturday morning and wanted to go out and walk, stroke, run 5 kilometres, 3 miles, then park run's a great place to start. I would also suggest you visit the database that exists, which was set up by British Blind Sport, which is findaguide.co.uk. And either yourself or somebody could assist in trying to locate guides in your area. But I mean, otherwise, you know, running clubs, gyms may be able to assist as well. But there's lots of opportunities for people to get into walking and running, regardless of your level of fitness and ability. And I don't think sight loss should prevent any one of us to go out and consider our fitness and well-being.
Absolutely. One thing that I've observed from guiding maybe 20 to 30 Achilles runners now is everyone is extremely grateful for being guided, but sometimes it feels like there's an imbalance of gratitude, feeling that guides are going above and beyond to facilitate runners with sight loss. So I just wanted to make it really clear that guiding is a very much a two-way symbiotic relationship. I get a lot out of guiding, from meeting new people, having a really enjoyable conversation on a run, and meeting people from all over London. So I think if that is at all a barrier for anyone that would be thinking of starting walking or running and feeling like it was an imposition, that it is certainly something that both members of that team really, really benefit from.
Definitely. I think the word you use there, a team, and I think that's a great thing, because actually we very much see it the same, that when we go out and we run with a guide, it's not my run, it's not the guide's run, it's us as a team. We very much try it as well to balance when we're pairing people, to ensure that it's not just that I will get a workout, it's about also they're going to get a workout. But I think also running is very much a social thing as well, and it gives us the opportunity, each and every one of us, the opportunity to socialize, have fun, and whilst we're doing that, to get a little bit of physical exercise.
So is there any advice from your now 15 years of running for anyone that's looking for that first step to get involved?
Definitely. So I don't think sight loss or age or current fitness should be a barrier to any one of us starting to pick up exercise. We definitely need to start small, and not everyone has got aspirations to run a marathon. So even if it's about just getting up, taking more steps each day, I think we can never understate the great stuff that physical activity brings to our mental health as well. So I would definitely say start small and see where it takes you.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for a lovely run this morning and for chatting to me this afternoon.
Not at all. Thank you so much for joining me.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include A Successful Summer for a Lifeguard, Keeping NHS Buildings Within Community Control, A Farmer's Work is Recognised for its Educational Value, and Preparing to Sell a Treasure Found with a Metal Detector.
Emily Morton, 17, from Aylsham, is club captain of North Norfolk Vikings Swimming Club and trains at least four nights a week. She started lifeguarding earlier this year after completing her qualification. Emily said, "The lifeguarding course was very full on, but it has given me a good knowledge of first aid and rescue scenarios." She won three medals at the Norfolk County Championships this year and wanted to put her swimming skills to use as a lifeguard. She said, "My swimming ability has been put to good use, thanks to Vikings, and I have recently become a qualified beach lifeguard. I'm thoroughly enjoying being part of their team. Being a strong swimmer means I have a good level of fitness, which helps me handle the rescue boards well, and the confidence to feel I can help someone if needed." Emily trains with Munsley's Surf Life Saving Club to keep her skills up to date and competes in regional and national life saving competitions. Julie Coleman, founder of the club, said, "We have a simple but powerful vision to create a water-safe community and prevent deaths from drowning. Our aim is to develop the life-saving skills, water confidence and teamwork that are at the heart of what we do, helping young people feel strong, included and empowered in and around the ocean." Emily also offered a safety message for beachgoers, saying, "My bit of advice is to recommend everyone to swim between the red and yellow flags whilst at the beach, so us lifeguards can keep you safe. We are a friendly bunch, so don't be afraid to ask if unsure about something. We are more than happy to help."
Benjamin Court, a re-ablement centre providing step-down care for hospital patients, was shut in June 2023 and has sat empty since. Health bosses have said they are unable to put the building back into use for commissioned services and are due to return it to NHS Property Service, which will seek an alternative tenant for it. But campaigners have now successfully fought for the building to be designated as an asset of community value. This will mean that should it ever be put up for sale or lease, it must be offered to community bodies first before the open market. Martin Booth, spokesman for the Benjamin Court campaign, said, "This is an important victory for the people of North Norfolk. This ruling reinforces our case and allows time for Benjamin Court to be favourably considered as a neighbourhood health hub, in line with the government's objectives of moving healthcare into the local communities. We call on those responsible for delivering health and care in our area to lose no time in making that happen. However, the future of the site remains in doubt after it was discussed by Norfolk County Council's Public Adult Social Care and Public Health Select Committee." Stefan Aquarone, North Norfolk MP, who was attending the meeting in his capacity as a councillor, said, "I maintain that this facility should never have been removed by Norfolk County Council without consultation, and I remain of that view. We are only here because the Save Benjamin Court community campaign has been so robust in drawing our attention to the deficit that has been left with it. I can't stress enough how we will have to be an active, if not activist, stakeholder in decisions on its future if we're going to fight for what our rural communities need."
The National Farmers Union, NFU, asked for public nominations for the title to mark the 10th anniversary of Back British Farming Day. Tim Papworth, a former NFU Norfolk chairman who farms at Felmingham near North Walsham, is one of many farmers across the country to have been given the honour. He was nominated for his work to teach children about food and farming as an NFU Farmers for Schools ambassador. This voluntary role sees Mr. Papworth give talks in schools about his life on the farm and take children on farm tours, helping them to understand where their food comes from and inspiring many about potential career paths in farming. Mr. Papworth said, "I do this because I love it. I was overcome by people's generosity for nominating me. I think it's important to teach children where their food comes from, so hopefully they will buy local and British in future. I show them how I produce something for every meal, and I'd like to encourage more people to buy British and consider a career in agriculture." The Papworth family's farming and contracting business has been in North Norfolk since 1926 and grows cereals, oilseeds, potatoes, peas, sugar beet and other crops alongside rearing livestock for its butcher shops. Mr. Papworth also keeps local footpaths maintained and clears roads from ice and snow in the winter. He said, "I am proud to be a farmer because of the quality of the food we produce. Britain grows the best food in the world and it's all very sustainable." Back British Farming Day is organised by the NFU to shine a national spotlight on the work of the nation's farmers. This year's event on Wednesday included a reception in Westminster, while union members also met their MPs and took part in various events taking place around the country.
A signet ring with links to Lord Nelson that was found in North Norfolk is expected to sell for £5,000 at auction. The ring was discovered by 63-year-old metal detectorist Michaela Betts on land belonging to Trunch Hall near North Walsham. In 1822, the Reverend Philip Ward, who was born at the Hall, married Horatia Nelson, the only surviving child of Lord Nelson and his mistress, Lady Emma Hamilton. Horatia's true parentage was kept secret by her famous parents to avoid public scandal, as both of them were married to other people. Rather than referring to her as their own, Horatia was referred to as their godchild, claiming she was the orphan of a fictitious sailor whose real mother had died in childbirth. The piece of jewellery is expected to make up to £5,000 at Hanson's Norfolk sale room in Rowton on September the 27th. "It was the find of a lifetime," Mrs. Bett said. "I knew immediately when I saw the ring that it was something special. Gold comes out of the ground the same colour as when it went in. The beautiful buttery colour is unmistakable. I can't explain the feeling. It is excitement, but you almost feel sick because it's a big responsibility to tell its story." The Rostrum auctioneer, Mark Nelson Griffiths, added, "Whichever way the ring came to be left in the field may never be known, but it is another wonderful and tangible link to Britain's greatest naval hero and the county of his birth."
Our last few articles cover bringing oyster reefs back to the region, reducing the distress to horses on bonfire night, the chance to enter your pet in a competition, and a rarer spotted cuckoo.
A North Norfolk town is leading a major project, restoring the UK's lost oyster reefs, with millions of the shellfish about to be sent on a mission to save the sea. Over the next 18 months, a nature conservation organisation is planning to rescue the endangered mollusks by recreating an oyster bank off the coast of Wells. The project, led by Oyster Heaven, will deploy 4 million of the humble shellfish on the sea floor by 2026, helping to clean and restore the North Sea. Native oysters once thrived in Britain's waters, but they have almost vanished, their population plunging by 95% since the mid-19th century, mainly down to overfishing and seabed trawling. The disappearance of the reefs left a gaping hole in local marine ecosystems, but the new restoration project means the oysters are set for a comeback. George Birch, founder of Oyster Heaven, said that oysters are the answer to many of the problems currently facing the North Sea. In a barn outside Wells, he demonstrated their superpower, filtering water. Two small tanks had been placed side by side, with algae added to both. After oysters were placed in one of them, the water had turned clear within 1 hour, while the water in the other tank remained murky and green. People used to talk about the North Sea being crystal clear, Mr. Birch said. At certain points, you could see the bottom with oysters on it, which is very difficult to imagine today. He explained that just one adult oyster can filter up to 200 litres of water in 1 day, stripping out excess nutrients such as nitrogen. The process improves the environmental conditions for other marine life and also prevents harmful algal blooms. Another benefit of oyster reefs is their tendency to attract other species. Oyster reefs attract fish, crabs, eels, seaweed, and sponges. They are a hot spot for life, Mr. Birch said. The oysters are currently growing on specially made bricks inside two large tanks in the barn. Within weeks, the Norfolk Seaweed Company, which is collaborating on the project, will begin taking the shellfish to their farm 2 miles from the coast at Wells Outer Harbour. A special rig with a crane and winch will lower the bricks containing the baby oysters into the sea before carefully tumbling them across the seabed. Most of the deployment work will take place next year between April and October. In total, the project will lay out 40,000 bricks, each impregnated with 100 young oysters. The oysters will then be monitored for the next decade, and it is hoped that a new reef will form and become self-sustaining, attracting other species of marine flora and fauna. Mr. Birch said the project could even pave the way for oysters to be fished again off the North Norfolk coast. Ali Wharf, co-founder of Norfolk Seaweed Company, said the project will revive the sea and lead it to a cleaner, better sea with more biodiversity. We're hoping to revive the native oyster population, restoring something that was historically there. Oyster reefs were once common along Britain's coastline, but the native oyster, Ostrea edulis, was almost wiped out by overfishing and trawling. Conservationists hope the return of these hot spots for life will boost biodiversity and create a healthier marine environment. Oyster Heaven is also working on the project with pet food company Purina, which uses fish byproducts in its products. Kirsten Smyduk, Director of Sustainability at Purina Europe, said, "We are thrilled to be working with Oyster Heaven, marking an important step towards improving marine restoration along the Norfolk coastline and a first for Purina in the UK."
A national horse sanctuary with sites in Norfolk has launched a plea to the government over bonfire night festivities. Red Wings is asking people to sign a petition that would see a reduction in the maximum permitted noise level of fireworks from 100 to 90 decibels. The horse welfare charity, which has sites in Aylsham, Hapton and Caldecott near Great Yarmouth, launched the petition this week with 50 days to go before bonfire night. It is asking anyone who would like to see improved regulation of fireworks to sign. Red Wings has lost 3 of its own rescued residents in the past. Despite efforts to keep them safe, Red Wings' Cinders, Sprite and Percy died in incidents relating to fireworks being let off near the sanctuary. Sprite and Percy were 2 veteran ponies living in a herd at Red Wings when a loud fireworks display was held in a neighbouring field in Norfolk in 2016. Sprite developed such severe colic that there was nothing the Red Wings vets could do but put him to sleep where he lay. Percy sustained a serious elbow injury and non-weight-bearing lameness. His pain levels didn't respond to medication, and again, there was no humane option other than to put Percy to sleep. Helen Whiteleg, Red Wings campaigns and policy manager, said, "We know there is widespread support for calls to tighten fireworks regulations, and we hope this is a positive way for people to make their voice heard and appeal to policymakers. Red Wings is not alone in having lost much-loved horses to fireworks, and the current lack of regulation also has far wider impacts, from pets, livestock and wildlife to people living with PTSD or sensory issues like autism. We fully appreciate that many people enjoy fireworks, but more balanced regulation is desperately needed. The sound of fireworks, more than the light, is believed to be the main issue for horses, which is perhaps no surprise, as animals have more sensitive hearing than people, and research suggests that horses' ears amplify sounds by around 10 to 20 decibels.
The fur is flying and the feathers are flapping as the much-loved Pet of the Year competition returns for 2025, promising another heartwarming celebration of the area's most cherished companions. Whether your pet barks, meows, neighs, chirps or slithers, this is their moment to shine. From dashing dogs and charismatic cats to radiant rabbits and show-stopping stallions, the contest is open to all creatures, great and small. We, the North Norfolk News, are calling on pet owners across the area to submit their most positively perfect pals for a chance to be crowned this year's ultimate champion. 2024 saw nearly 2,500 entries, with everything from cats and dogs to horses and budgies and even the more exotic tortoises and snakes. All are welcome at Pet of the Year. How it works? Nominations are currently in the paper. Simply find the nomination form and scan the QR code to be taken to the online entry form and upload a picture of your pet. All nominations must be received by Sunday, the 5th of October. Nominations will then appear in the Pet of the Year supplement on Thursday, October the 30th, where readers will be asked to vote for their favourite. The grand champion will walk away with a trophy and bragging rights for life. So, fluff up those feathers, polish those paws, and strike a pose. Fame, glory, and tail wags await.
A rare bird has been spotted flying through the skies above a North Norfolk coastal village. Cuckoos are classified as red-listed, meaning they are of the highest conservation priority, with species on this list needing urgent action to save them. The bird was seen sweeping through the skies over Salthouse and has been in the area for the last 10 days, says one local. Adam Spruce said, "I visited the site numerous times over the past week or so to capture the cuckoo. On a closer look, I saw that this bird is a juvenile. He must have been stocking up on berries, fattening himself ready for the trip to Africa." The RSPB described cuckoos as a dove-sized bird with a blue-grey back, head and chest and a stripy black and white belly. Cuckoos are most famous for being brood parasites, meaning that they don't build their own nests, but the female cuckoos instead lay their eggs in other birds' nests.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Julia Bloomfield. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time But for now, it's
cheerio! Cheerio.